What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
J.W. Weatherman, thanks for coming on the pod. And here we are, right on the cusp of the least important election in United States history. How are you?
Good, man. Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm just so excited to talk to you. How you doing?
I'm good. I worked a little too hard yesterday and then took the day off today and went down the crazy conspiracy rabbit hole a little bit too much. So I'm a little bit depressed, but
but
I'll bounce back.
That's interesting. I'm curious what you were looking at. I think of you as, you know, a little bit cynical, but I also, your conclusions in your writings make me think you're optimistic at heart. So what were you looking at that was bugging you out?
Actually, I was just looking at the whole COVID thing and just trying to figure it out a little bit more. And I think the thing that frustrates me is, and it doesn't even matter, but the thing that frustrates me is just trying to figure out whether, you know, who's doing stuff on purpose and who's doing stuff accidentally. COVID in particular has been very frustrating because it's been so stupid from day one. And it's happened fast enough. Like, I watched kind of the global warming thing develop, and there's, you know, it's messy, right? Like, the Earth probably is increasing in temperature, but we're talking about like over millennia of time.
Right.
And you know, there's a legitimate sort of connection between carbon emissions and, you know, potentially, right, between carbon emissions and temperature. And, you know, so it's not completely just utter nonsense from like the very first time you scratch it all the way through. And COVID has been that. Like, there's never been a moment since it hit South Korea where it's, or there's anybody's been able to present a good reason to be worried about it. And that I think it's just frustrating, man. It's just, it pisses me off that it's so obviously stupid.
Right.
It's also like, it's a worldwide thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, nothing has come anywhere close to this in our lifetime of just like kind of remaking the world over a short period of months. And I, you know, there's part of me that's like, it's just because I'm in my 40s now. Like, I'm just a crotchety old bastard, and I, you know, a little bit of bad news, and I can't handle it and put it in perspective. But it's pretty weird. I mean, it's weird going to the grocery store. It's weird seeing little kids wear masks. It's weird that everybody's terrified except for me.
It's dystopian.
Yeah, it's a trip.
Yeah, you said something earlier. You know, who do you think is doing stuff on purpose?
So, I mean, it's really clear that there's a tendency among, you know, there's like a very long standing conspiracy to try to create like a one world government. I think when you say that, people are like, oh, that's crazy. But like the whole concept behind the UN, and there's legitimate arguments for it, right? Because the world that we live in right now is a world where every central bank is at war with every other central bank. Right. Unless they're pegged to the US dollar. And so they're kind of subservient.
Right.
And, you know, World War I, World War II, these things are all tied into currencies where one country wants to print more money. And Germany, you know, has been at the center of this a lot. Right. They wanted to, you know, they wanted to stay at one of the major factors. Right. It wasn't all just about, I don't know. It wasn't all just about the assassination of some dude.
Right, which is the way we learn it in school, yeah.
Yeah, that's as far as they'll let you take it. But it was actually had a lot to do with the fact that the Germans were running a more, well, they wanted to stay on a gold standard, right? And a lot of other countries wanted to be able to print freely. And that creates a big problem because if, you know, let's say that Great Britain is going to print a bunch of money, and the Germans are going to stay on a gold standard, then that money's going to move to Germany, right?
Right.
So you either don't get to print and you know, depending on how cynical you are, you either don't get to print and steal from the British people, or you don't get to print and use that power to, you know, defend your borders and things like that. So, you know, there is a legitimate sort of argument for a global currency, and there's a legitimate argument not that I'm saying I agree with it, but there's some, you don't have to be insane to think that that would be better. And there's, you know, there's a legitimate argument for sort of a one world government as well. And it, you know, it sounds super crazy, but if you put it in historical context, like the world's a much smaller place, we're much more connected. And there was a legitimate argument in the founding of the United States where, you know, Madison was arguing that we needed a more powerful central government to protect us from the corrupt little local government jerks, right? So, and it's not totally obvious all the time which one is worse. I think the cool thing about the cypherpunk movement and the cool thing about Bitcoin is that it's not clear whether you're better off getting abused locally or globally, but it is clear you're better off just taking that power out of the system altogether,
right?
Where if we can have a function like money production, and it's just not possible for any tyrant, whether they're a bunch of local tyrants that, you know, the advantage to having local tyrants is maybe you have more influence on them. The disadvantage is they're closer to you, right? Mm-hmm. Like they know you.
Right.
And on the other side, you know, the disadvantage of having like a tyrant that's far away is he might not know you as well, but if he's more efficient at abusing you and it's more powerful overall, then you end up more abused. But yeah, if you can find a way to take any of those functions out of the hands of tyrants altogether, that's a no-brainer. And I think a lot of times when we look at like, you know, the George Soroses or the Bloombergs or, you know, these guys that are doing stuff that looks really, really evil, it's easy to forget that, like, without something like Bitcoin, we don't really have a whole lot of straightforward answers to those problems, right? Like, if Bitcoin didn't exist and I was running the Federal Reserve, I have no idea what I would do. Would I shut it down? Well, if you shut it down, then other countries are going to be able to use that power and have more influence over the United States. You might as well just shut the United States off, right? It's pretty obvious, I think, because it doesn't exist, that it's not possible to have a government right now that doesn't abuse its people efficiently enough to be able to at least push other countries around. So it's not a good situation to be in. And I think it's easy for us, if we've been in Bitcoin for a while, to forget that without kind of the insights of the cypherpunk movement, it really is just a lot of flailing around and trying to, you know, choose between a lot of really bad options.
Right. What are some of these insights from the cypherpunk movement that really kind of speak to you, or you think really are you're thinking about in the current climate?
So, I mean, the overall concept between, or you know, like if you read the cypherpunk manifesto and the other stuff that Eric Hughes and Tim May was the guy that was most influential for me,
right?
Partly because I got to know him before he died and did a few interviews with him, and I'd be able to bounce emails off of him just if I was thinking about something. So he definitely had a big influence on me over the last few years. One of the, you know, if not the key insight of the cypherpunk movement was that politics, you know, voting, Tim May called it setting up card tables, is just not a, you know, an efficient way to, or an effective way to change the world. You're much better off building technology that changes the landscape. Mm-hmm. And encryption was the main thing that they were focused on, of course. But encryption opens up all these other doors, like Bitcoin and e-commerce and BitTorrent, all those sort of things.
Right.
So I think that's the central insight, and I think it is very helpful. When I do kind of go try to figure out what's going on, I do kind of come back to a couple things. One is God's in control; it's going to be fine, and just get back to work and build something. Mm-hmm.
So going back to the one world government, how much do you think that is, you know, a concerted effort versus maybe a conspiracy without conspirators?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a concerted effort on multiple levels. There's no question that like the World Economic Forum, I mean, they get together at least once a year in Davos, and you know, you kind of want to be there, right? You want to be part of that kind of in group. But what they're doing is they're planning, right? I mean, it seems cool, it seems interesting, but at the end of the day, it's probably a lot like a lot of the sort of executive meetings that I've been to. You end up with a bunch of people that are just kind of trying to network, and they're trying to, you know, build their careers and that sort of stuff. And they're just naturally planners, right? Like we're all like bureaucrats, right? Like if you've been an executive at a larger company, you don't actually do anything in that role. You're just sort of this weird figurehead role where you try to kind of keep people fired up a little bit. And, you know, occasionally you get to make a decision that gets overruled two levels down anyway, because it hardly matters. So, you know, there's no question that these guys get together regularly and they do plan, right? Mm-hmm. But most of the time they put out documents that nobody reads, right? And they put out sort of, I don't know, like even like the Agenda 21 thing, which is a very, like a big focus on like conspiracy theories of what's going on right now. I mean, it's clearly a conspiracy, right? Like but if you read that document, and I had the displeasure of flipping through that a little bit today, it's absolutely vacuous, right? Like it doesn't say anything. Right. So it's like most management documents that come out. So there's definitely a lot of that going on. And a lot of these guys think, you know, as soon as you kind of accept that like global warming exists or climate change exists or COVID is a real threat, it's really hard for any of these guys to think, well, you know, there's going to be a lot of negative consequences, but it just has to be that way, right? They're going to be in the, we got to do something about this camp. And that necessitates some sort of global policy.
Right.
And global policy is just another way of saying global government. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of that going on. And then at the, you know, on the other side there is nationalism, and it's, I mean, for me, I'm not sure what I hate more.
Right.
People trying to get together and make global rules, or people trying to get together and make, you know, continent-wide.
Right, the homogenous gang or the local gang.
Right. And, I mean, and even the homogenous gang, it's not like, you know, it's not like the United States is a particular race, right? We've got this concept of, like, a nation.
Right.
And I'm not saying that it would be better if it was. I'm just saying it's not really homogenous. So, like, the location of borders and that sort of stuff. You know, there's definitely a culture in the U.S. And I, you know, if you're asking me practically what works better, I would say local is better, because as we've seen, countries get bigger and bigger, they don't tend to become weaker and weaker in the process, and they're having more of an influence, I would say, over our daily lives than they have in the past.
Right.
But you know, as my wife was reminding me a couple hours ago, like it hasn't been that long since Vietnam, right? So it does piss me off when I see little kids wearing masks, but my parents' generation, you know, their parents were saying, well, Timmy, I'm really sorry, but you got this note in the mail, and that means you have to get on an airplane and, you know, go kill some people and maybe get killed, and we'll see if you come back. So I don't know. It's not clear that I just don't have a very good perspective on how bad things have been in the past. But in my lifetime, COVID is definitely the weirdest thing that's happened.
Yeah, I think both strip us of our humanity. You know, going off to destroy other humans, or, you know, I think the masks really, I find them, and I'm not going to get into necessarily, I want to hear your thoughts on what COVID is, but the masks to me, when people are using them, it just strips us of all our humanity. I feel like I'm on Planet of the Apes. And it dehumanizes us. And I think that is in some way social engineering. And I worry about the effects of this. And I see people outside walking their dog by themselves and wearing a mask, and I don't think they're ever going back to taking it off.
Yeah, the thing that disturbs me about it is that, I mean, if you put everything else aside, like central banks are basically operating a slave society, and it's not clear whether we'd be better off with like a single slave master, you know, sort of organization, whether we'd be better off with like local slave masters. But at the end of the day, central banking is, you know, as I call it in some of the stuff that I've written, central bank slavery, right? It's just a far more efficient way to steal our wealth. than racial slavery was.
Right.
That had to end after the Industrial Revolution, but partly because central bank slavery is better, right? And it's just outcompeting it as a way to extract wealth from people systematically. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think this part of you, this piece that you wrote, The Human Threat Vector, it's a lot of big ideas. And I came across it maybe a year or two ago, and I've been having this conversation with you in my head since then. And, you know, you bring up something like industrialization ended racial slavery. And you know, that's something that's a new idea to me. And it was really hard for me to grok it when I came across it the first time. You know, it's in your 10 hours of Bitcoin towards the end. And it's now much more clear to me what you're doing with that program. And I implore people to go to 10hoursofbitcoin.com. I think it's a great way for even hardcore Bitcoiners to go through some of these subjects. But yeah, how did industrialization end racial slavery?
So I think there's kind of two ways that you can look at history. And I think, I think Tim May has had, I think I kind of had this perspective a little bit before, but certainly it developed pretty, I got some more clarity on it, I think, thanks to some of the stuff that Tim May wrote. But I think when you look at something like racial slavery, right, you have to either conclude that human nature changed, right? That maybe for a long period of time, people were okay with enslaving somebody else or treating them different. You know, they convinced themselves that the blacks were inferior, that they, you know, that they could be owned, and there wasn't any ethical problem with this. And you know, they morphed Christianity into this disfigured thing that would allow them to sort of justify it. And they lived this way for many, many generations, right? And then one day they just became more moral, right? They just became more ethical, and they were like, you know, this whole system, it just doesn't feel right. So that's one way. And that's kind of the public school version of what happened in the United States, that white people just on their own without any external influence behaved a certain way for a really long period of time and then just stopped and just decided it was wrong. And you know, there's probably some truth to that. Like, I do think that over time people can change, but that's a pretty drastic change. And I think given the fact that it happens to coincide with all these labor saving devices, right? Like this is forced labor. You're beating people to do these jobs. And it just happens to coincide with like the invention of the cotton gin and like the harvesters and all these sort of things that replace that job. I don't think that's coincidental. And I also think that, you know, if you're looking at somebody changing their behavior and there's not really an obvious reason for it, and they say, oh, it's just because I became a nicer guy, and you find out, well, it turns out they were getting a check and then they're not getting a check anymore. Right. It's, I think you can conclude pretty reasonably that their incentives are the reason that they changed their behavior. So it's pretty clear to me that with the Industrial Revolution, labor saving devices, right? Factories essentially, made the sorts of labor that you could beat somebody to do a lot cheaper. And if the costs of beating somebody and purchasing them, beating them, feeding them, all that sort of stuff remains the same, but the competing system to get that work done becomes much cheaper. And at the same time, you decide, okay, we're not going to practice this anymore. I think it's pretty obvious that, you know, that was a major thing, major factor, if nothing else.
Right.
And I think it's helpful to look at what's going on right now in the same way. But it's also kind of disturbing. And I think, like, if you look at COVID, so right now we're under central bank slavery, right? The main way you have taxation, you have monopolies, government sponsored monopolies, you have all these ways that they extract wealth from you.
Right. What you call slavery, I shouldn't say you call it, you've defined as slavery. And this was really hard for me to grok. I mean, this is a lot of verticals you're going into. And a lot of people, you know, the word slave is very taboo in our society, our lexicon, and to equate anything else with slavery is taboo. And I think you're making incredibly valid and sound equations here. And it, to be honest, these really took me a hard time to come around to. I had to read this a year or two ago and sit on it for a while. And it's interesting in your writings about this, you use words like attacker and victim, and those were hard for me to kind of see as bigger than singular entities. You know, like attacker is the central bank, and the victim is humanity. How do you go about explaining to someone that socialism is slavery or, you know, socialist policy?
Yeah.
And to give the underdrop to that, I'm sorry to cut you off. Bernie Sanders in the conversation, you know, politically, and it's not a show about politics, we're above it. But, you know, what you see going on and COVID and what I think is happening with like sort of a rollout of temporary UBI through COVID and all these incentives.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely had to give a lot of thought to the word that, you know, that word slavery. I kind of struggled with it too. And I think one of the things that's really helpful is when you come across some concept, right, like something, and you don't have the right word for it, stop and try to figure out what the word is, right? Because when you have a label, then you have a mental category for the thing, and then you can build on top of that. But you got to get it right. And with something like central banking and how that works, you really got to think about like, what does it do? And what it does is it steals your productivity. It steals your time, right? It steals your wealth. But you know, if somebody just walks up to you and punches you and grabs your wallet and runs off, we just call that theft, right? So what do we call this thing where it's systematic theft, right? Like every day, it's just baked into the system. Like from the time that you were born to the time that you die, you're regularly going to be stolen from. And it turns out that is a great way to describe slavery, because there have been all kinds of different forms of slavery throughout history. There's been slavery like in Florida, there was an Indian tribe. And they actually figured out that some of the Africans that escaped from like Georgia when they went down to Florida, they could be exploited. And so they created these weird relationships where the Indians would periodically, I think it was maybe, you know, a couple times a year, they would show up to these, essentially black village areas, and they would steal from them. And it was like a tax, right? And you think about stuff like that, it's like, well, that isn't the same as somebody whipping you on your back constantly, right, and telling you to pick cotton, but it's still systematic, right? It's still like you expect it. And then you look at the fact that like even in the South, where this is supposed to be, you know, if you're an American educated kid, this is supposed to be the height of like the worst form of slavery that's ever existed, right? Even in that situation, there were cases where the slave owners would let all of the the slave owners would intentionally not be within, you know, dozens of miles of the slaves. He didn't want to sleep next to him. There's obviously security issues there. You know, nobody would like to cut his throat probably more than the last guy that got beat. So there were systems where the slave owner would be far from the group of slaves, and the group of slaves would have, you know, like basically their own overseer that was himself a slave, right? And they would be far away, and they would just send the goods back, right? So and sometimes they didn't even see the guy. Or, you know, there would be situations where people would be out working and, you know, the slave owner would come through periodically. So you start trying to think about like all, and this is how words work, right? You're trying to define something, and you're like, all right, I need to create a category for this. I need to put a label on it. What are all the things? And you just start like trying to put all the things on the table and saying, all right, what do they have in common? And the thing that they all have in common is that there's this relationship where you know that the slave master, right? And I'm using the terms as I'm explaining it, but there's no easy way to do this. Otherwise, the slave master has this expectation that he's taking your stuff on a regular basis without your consent. And the slave himself has an expectation that he's getting his stuff taken from him on a regular basis without his consent. And this actually ties into the American Revolution, that slogan, like no taxation without representation, right? So the American revolutionaries, they thought, we're clearly having our stuff taken from us without our consent, right? The British are, they're passing all these crazy taxes. You know, we can't even get a piece of paper unless it has the right stamp on it. And that's now super expensive. Tea taxes, all this stuff was hitting them. And they're like, look, there's no difference between us and a slave. And it was a very moral, philosophical, like realization that they had, or at least realization that they sold to the people that ended up fighting in the war. They didn't want to consider themselves slaves. So their sort of out was, well, hey, if we have representation, then we are consenting, right? We're not having our stuff taken from us on a regular basis without our consent, because that's slavery. But if we have representation and we're voting on it or making decisions, you know, as a community, then it's different, right? Then it, and I'm not sure I really buy that, because, you know, I think it was Rothbard that said, democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner, something along those lines. Right. So I'm not really sure that the sheep two wolves and a sheep. I'm not really sure that the sheep is consenting in that circumstance, but right. That was the idea, of wanting to make sure that they had representation. So, you know, I think it's really hard to do that. It's really hard to like sit down and say, okay, I need a label for this thing, and I want to look through all of the classes or all the instances of it and try to come up with a label. But if you do that, I think you end up with some pretty profound insights sometimes. And you know, for me, I just can't look at any relationship where, whether you agree or not, your stuff is getting taken from you on a regular basis and not call it slavery. And I can't look at any other example of slavery and not see that that's the fundamental relationship there.
Right. So how does socialism play into a form of slavery, though? How would you kind of get that across to someone who's never heard that idea?
Yeah, so I'll give you a quick recap of why I would say central banking is slavery.
Sure.
And that is that you're forced without your, like you're forced, you're not consenting to this thing. You have to use these dollars, right? You have to pay your taxes in these dollars, which is also, you know, another sort of form of slavery. And if anybody demands a debt, you have to pay it. So you're stuck in this system where you have to use these dollars. And if you try to create competition, right, if you try to be Liberty Reserve and you say, hey, you know, it's we don't really like the dollar very much, we're going to try to create something else, you get kicked in the back of the head and thrown in jail and punished. So you're forced to use these things, and the central bank can print them. So what that means is that anytime you're holding them and they print more of them, they're stealing your wealth, right? You work for 10 bucks. 10 bucks is worth, you know, an hour of your time. You've got that in your wallet and you're planning on going and buying 10 bucks worth of bread with it. And, you know, the guy at the central bank prints out a couple of trillion bucks. And now you can only buy $8 worth of bread for the 10 bucks that you had. And they get that other $2, right? It's not as if this money that they print goes into thin air. They actually get it, right? There is a guy, like the 22% increase in the money supply that has occurred in last year in the United States. There are people that have that 22%. It's not everybody. It didn't go out in those stimmy checks. There was a chunk of it that went out in those stimmy checks, but not much of it really.
Right.
So that's what's going on with central banking. With socialism, it's kind of the culmination of all of this, where you're back to something that looks a lot more like racial slavery, where all of your stuff, right, is given to you, or all of your food, all of your resources are given to you by the slave owner, which is just another way of saying that all of your labor is stolen, except for the little bit that they give back to you.
Right.
It's clear that you're still working, right? They don't let you just like take a holiday. So you're still having to go to work, and you're not living as good of a lifestyle as you would if they weren't running off and buying champagne with it.
I think the key to your piece, you know, is the sentiment that the human project is a project to make the world more delightful. And that's why I think, you know, or feel that you have this underlying optimism. And I think that's how you kind of get at this, you know, all these forms of slavery, you know, because you get at that humanity, you know, humans have this will to be, this desire to be productive, to make enough to subsist. And all humans seem to have this capability to produce more than they would eat or need to live. And that these forms of slavery are metaphysical forms of violence that detract from our ability to make the world delightful.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So a real simple example is, you know, if you're working and you're trying to build a home for your family, right? And you're out actually just assembling it, you're buying wood and you're putting it together. Anything that hinders that is making the world for you, for your kids, for your neighbors, for anybody else that you might offer shelter to, for whoever is going to end up buying your house, maybe after you die, inherit it, whatever, less delightful, right? And that's exactly what governments, corrupt governments, and trying to define the difference between a government and a corrupt government can get tricky, but yeah, the difference between your what your life would be if you were just allowed to build your house and somebody showing up and saying, oh, by the way, you know, you have to give me a little action to have a permit to be able to build your house.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You brought up the World Economic Forum earlier. And, you know, someone who kind of studied finance and economics growing up through, you know, institutions like college and high school and stuff like public schools, you know, I'm familiar with those organizations, but I do feel that they're messaging more to the regular public. I see them on Twitter putting up videos, like World Economic Forum put up a video today. And I feel like that video is not made for you and me per se. I think it's kind of made to message. And it's interesting right. that it kind of appears more in my Twitter feed. I know American Hoddle tried to retweet this video and he said he got suspended for it. And the video was dystopian as could be, but painted as utopia. It said, you know, in the year 2030, you'll have nothing and you'll be happy about it.
Right.
And yep. So I mean, I see that as concerted messaging. And I'm just, I can't get my hands around, like, who is driving that kind of message and making it sane?
I think I have there's two kind of like just perspectives on it, right? One is that you have like these really evil guys that are like, you know, pedophiles and they're going out on Epstein Island and when they're not abusing kids, they're in a room and they're just plotting all this stuff out. And then the other sort of extreme would be, this is just a completely natural consequence of sort of human nature, right? Being arrogant, thinking that you can do central planning, that you can actually control all of these things. And you know, you can put it in a spreadsheet. And if I'm going to make a decision about what car I should buy, and I can do a really good job on Consumer Reports, I might as well make that decision for 30 million Americans because they're not as smart as I am. And I'm going to do all the research and then we're going to decide what cars all the Americans are going to drive, you know, that fall into this category or whatever. And I think that the reality is it's like, it's a little bit of both. There is definitely an inherent part of humanity where we just think that, you know, unless we've been educated, we think that we can make these sort of decisions at a much greater scale effectively than we really can. But there are also some really, you know, some twisted characters out there. And I think like, if you look at somebody like George Soros or Bill Gates or any of these guys that are big players right now, I tend to think that it's more of good intentions, than just being completely malicious, but that's not really a good thing because the way we're wired, I think, if they knew that they were being super destructive and evil, they'd probably end up with coke habits or, you know, end up with STDs or something and just die off. Unfortunately, I think that they're pretty motivated and they think a lot of times that they're actually doing good. And that keeps them going. And they're just wrong about the right ways to do that good. So, you know, like that video from the World Economic Forum, I did see that. And it is really dystopian if you know what you're looking at. But I think the way something like that gets produced is you have like sort of this executive group and they're like, hey, we really, you know, we think that it's really inefficient for 14, you know, how many screwdrivers are made per year? You know, that we make a million screwdrivers a year. Well, you know, those things sit on the shelf. Why can't we make those more efficient? Well, yeah, I guess we could. If we just had a warehouse that was local, we'd only need 400 screwdrivers. screwdrivers. Like there's only 400 screwdrivers in any city that are being used at any, on any given day, or, you know, something like that. And you can kind of like, especially if you've been around these sort of people, you could fall into that madness pretty easy, just by throwing stuff in spreadsheets and going, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. And the reality is that if that's done in like an entrepreneurial context, then it's fun and interesting. And maybe you end up with some crazy dude that's got a rent-a-tool service, right? And it gets tested out. But if you put that same sort of entrepreneurial spirit in context of people that don't understand that, that needs to be sort of done as an experiment, and that just because they put it in a spreadsheet doesn't mean it's true, right? There's an arrogance and a complete lack of humility that is very common, especially among the type of people that are attracted to government.
Sure.
Then you end up with like, you know, this policy paper or something, right? And then it gets translated by, you know, some intern. You know, that video probably doesn't have more than $10,000 behind it. And there's probably two interns that worked on it, and they think it's really slick and cool. And you know, I certainly don't think that they see how jarring it is. To say, oh, you know, you're not going to own anything and you'll be happy. And they definitely don't see like the contradiction in the very next idea, which I think was this idea that like, you're not going to own anything because you're just going to have an app like Uber. And you're going to say, I don't own a screwdriver, but I need a screwdriver. And I hit a button and then the drone delivers it. Right. Even if you have 400 screwdrivers, right, how do you decide who gets what? Like, that's why we have money. That's why we have ownership. But these people are not real deep thinkers. And so I don't think they're really considering that, that as a serious impediment. And they don't know history, right? Like you talk to some of these guys and, you know, what was the cause? Like we were talking before, like what was the cause of World War I? Oh, Duke Ferdinand assassin. So one guy gets killed and it causes a world war. That's as deep as you can go. You don't know that there's any sort of banking relationship that was behind this. There's no shift in the way that humans are farmed, essentially, with central bank slavery that might have played a role. Nope. I mean, it's just total flatline. So right. I do think that there are people that are trying to create a global government because it's for they think it's for the best. I think there are other people that are trying to do it so that they can, because they think they're going to end up, you know, with more power, and that's what they're trying to do. And I think a lot of times it's both of those forces in the same monkey head, that are driving it.
Yeah. I mean, the rollout of like things like lockdowns seemed across countries seemed extremely coordinated. And everything has seemed coordinated since then, even just a lot of opinions that come from world leaders. And it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, at the top of the show, I joke, you know, that it's the least important election in U.S. history, probably the most important election coming up in November, though. And for me, you know, on issues that matter to me at a federal level, I don't see a lot of daylight between these two guys. But on issues that don't matter to me on a federal level, yeah, it's night and day. But I don't think a lot of those conversations should be had at a federal or national level. However, you know, cultural, social issues. But I do think America is at, you know, the precipice of its most pivotal moment in maybe 100 years, regardless of the election, and how the administrations move forward, whoever wins. But I do think we're at a pivotal moment. And what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I'm very disturbed by what I've seen with COVID. I think a lot of us are very, I'm not totally sure how to process it, because I really thought the average American was a lot more rebellious than he seems to be right at this point.
Would the founding fathers just be weeping?
Well, I think that the average American back then wasn't too bright either. Like there's a reason that George Washington had boots on, you know, and looked dapper, and all the soldiers were freezing, and those paintings, nobody ever really, you know, George Washington crossing the river, nobody ever realizes that, like, yeah, he was probably clothed pretty well because he was one of the richest men in the country.
Right.
And you got a lot of people that are starving and fighting. And,
yeah.
They're not going to be net beneficiaries of this revolution. But they weren't in a lot of ways. I mean, look, the Whiskey Rebellion not long after.
Right.
So I don't want to overestimate how great the average American was 100 years ago. You know, the Civil War was a total disaster as well. And a lot of normal people suffered and had this really creepy religion. You know, the saints go marching in. Like, there was some really disturbing death cult stuff going on in the Civil War that was affecting millions. You know, that millions of people were a part of this weird, creepy death cult. So I don't want to overestimate like how great the average American was before. I just thought he was more of a pain in the ass than this, right? I just thought he was the kind of, the average American was a little bit, had a little bit too much testosterone to walk into a grocery store and put on a mask that he, I mean, and a little bit too much intelligence, right? Like this,
right.
This whole idea that these, you know, first you didn't need to wear masks, then you did need to wear masks, and now it's, you know, and it's gone back and forth like 17 times, but the average American seems to be so stupid that he doesn't know that it needs to be an N95, and right. At the same time, so submissive that he's willing to you know.
Do you think masks do anything?
So for me, when the whole COVID thing hit, when it was in China, before it came out of China, it looked pretty scary. And yeah. I think China did a really good job on putting out videos of people falling over.
Right.
And,
amazing. You know, those videos disappeared. They were really impactful in my thinking back then.
Right. Yeah, me too. I mean, they showed people getting welded in buildings, which right. I look back on that now and I'm like, you know, I was a little skeptical, but that should have been enough for me. The circumstances under which, whether they're sick
or not. So what's going on there? What is China doing there? What do you think happened?
Well, I think in hindsight, we know that they put those videos out on purpose, right? We know that this was intentional to convince everybody that there was something really terrifying happening there. We know they had like 300,000 plus Twitter accounts that they were using to build up a lot of fear and hysteria while they were putting those videos out. So that's fairly verified, I think, at this point. And we know that they shifted gears from Wuhan to Italy, as right. Like all those Twitter accounts, those 300,000 Twitter accounts went from talking about how terrifying China is to talking about how terrifying Italy
yeah.
is. So it's pretty obvious, I think, in hindsight, that it was intentional to
kick it off. Is that psychological warfare?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's information warfare, psychological warfare. You know, were they doing it just to screw with other countries' economies? Maybe. But then, I mean, as you start looking at how it developed and the fact that there hasn't been any pushback really from anybody to speak of, I think, was it Iran or somebody like that?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, yeah, the coordination around like what was going on in Italy and the videos coming out of Italy was weird. Like there was a lot of videos of when they shut down that particular region and people were fleeing, but people were fleeing because they didn't want to be stuck there. But the videos right. were shown in a different light. And then Iran, the presidential regime is infected and they're all coming back from a flight from China. And it was just really interesting how that rolled out and seemed coordinated. Every world leader got it, or their wife or her husband got it. Right. A lot of celebrities all seemed to tested early, get it, raising hysteria very quickly. Yeah. And I was someone who was like, hey, you know, let's run for the hills. Let's figure out what's going on. Shut it down. I didn't mean like shut it down, like tell me to shut it down. I'm going to shut it down for myself. You do right. you. So.
Yeah, before I left China, I was pretty concerned. I mean, I was like the one guy in the neighborhood that was having food delivered. I had some N95 masks. I would go outside, you know, I think it was only about a 2-week period, but I didn't leave the house for a couple weeks. I bleached everything when it came in.
Me too.
And, but then as soon as it hit South Korea, I was like, oh, this is bullshit. There's no mortality here. There's no infection rate here. I don't trust the numbers coming out of China. Now, what was funny is that everybody was like, well, you can't trust the numbers coming out of China because China's trying to manipulate us. But China was the one that had the high mortality rate, right? They were the one that had the people falling over in the streets and all that sort of stuff. So for me, when it hit South Korea, I was like, well, I think I trust South Korea's numbers a lot more than what was coming out of China. But that, like, China's our enemy sentiment in the United States was so strong that it was like, no, they have to be underestimating, right? Even though they're clearly, in hindsight, South Korea was legit and it matches right. what we've seen in every other developed country. But yeah, at the time it was, oh no, they're way underreporting. And there's still people now that are like, I'm sure there's a lot of Trump supporters that are like, oh, it's the China virus. It's here because China underestimated how bad it was and wouldn't tell us. No, the reality is it's not bad. We all know it's not bad. I mean, Trump's had it now, but there's still this cognitive dissonance, right? Like it was super dangerous in Wuhan.
Do you really think he had it?
Oh, Trump? Yeah, I think there's so many it's so many layers of BS at this point. I don't think we have any tests to know if somebody had it
right.
with any degree of certainty. There's no symptoms that are distinguishable from a cold or maybe a mild flu for, you know, to do any kind of diagnosis on whether you have it. So I don't know if you could answer the question, has anybody ever had this thing?
Do you think this is a novel new virus, or do you think that this is a virus they just started to count to kind of roll out some sort of fear program?
I think that coronaviruses, I mean, so we know there are at least, I think there's 7 different viruses that cause cold and flu-like symptoms. And there's not really a huge distinction between a cold and a flu. Like, When they talk about a flu, it's like pneumonia-like symptoms, I think is how the CDC has always categorized it, right? So like a cold virus can cause a flu, and you know it's pretty sloppy. And we've identified at least, or we had identified, I think, 7 different viruses that cause cold and flu-like symptoms. We have like the coronavirus, the rhinovirus, and you know a few other things, right? But things like the coronavirus or the rhinovirus, they mutate every year. That's why you can get sick every year. They're constantly changing, right? So it's not like you get the coronavirus once and then you're immune to it. You're going to get sick pretty much every cold season, right? Or every 2 or 3 cold seasons. So in that sense, we have a novel coronavirus every year, right? Or there wouldn't be a cold, and flu. So
right. But if you just count the cold, I mean, if you just count the cold and flu, you know, I mean, how you count things, you just distort what you're counting up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that there are, so we had sequenced like 7 or something viruses that we know cause cold and flu symptoms, but we've never attempted to sequence all of them. Like sequencing of these viruses has been fairly expensive in the past. So we think that there's a lot more. Right. And if you've never tried to count them and tag them and identify them, it's like there's a lot of animals out there, but we don't know how many until you start trying to tag each one and count them up. Right. So there's very possibly millions of viruses that cause cold and flu like symptoms. And they're just out there. So either this was a virus that we've had before and it mutated, or it's a new virus, or it's one of the millions that we get periodically and we just don't have it tagged and tracked and we don't measure it. My guess is it's probably that category. It's probably something that humanity's been living with for a really long time because we handle it very well, right? If it was something that was totally different, you would expect it would hurt us a little bit. And it really doesn't. I mean, it has zero impact. Like even Elon Musk, how many months ago, was on Joe Rogan and was like, Joe, it has zero impact on life expectancy. How can something be dangerous that has zero impact on life expectancy? That's the definition of danger, is it has an impact on life expectancy. I mean, imagine like, I'm going to go skydiving. Oh, that's dangerous. Well, it has zero impact on life expectancy.
Right.
It can't be dangerous then, right?
Right.
So yeah, I don't really know exactly where this thing came from, but my guess is it's pretty mundane. And there's, I mean, what I would say is I don't think anybody has presented any evidence that this thing is anything other than extremely mundane and disinteresting, except for the way that it's been handled and the response. And yeah, I mean, you're right. On one hand, I think, in general, these sort of things like was put out by the World Economic Forum are not all that nefarious, but this has been a global campaign to terrorize the entire planet. And it does seem way too coordinated. It seems too obvious to anybody that was kind of paying attention that this thing is stupid. And it's really hard for me to believe that you know, like I said, I think it was Turkey, or it was a country like that in the Middle East that was like, no, it wasn't even that. There was one world leader that was like, and I think he's a dictator, that I remember, he said, nope, coronavirus doesn't exist. And if you even say the word, it's illegal. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to, in hindsight, he seemed to know that this was a information warfare campaign and he was shutting it down. But the fact that it was like universally accepted all the way around the globe, and there was never a shred of evidence that it was dangerous.
Yeah.
It's very disturbing. And I would say that I think it is a huge innovation, right, in sort of human farming, because they've come up with a way. I think global warming was a similar sort of boogeyman, right? They've come up with a way to tell us that they need to control all aspects of our life to keep us safe, right? Yeah. It's got to be a global thing, right? This is not a local problem. This is a global problem. So we really need to be able to make these policies, you know, globally. I think that's a hell of an innovation, and I don't think that it's accidental. And especially that, like you said, the way that it was rolled out seems way too coordinated and way too effective.
Yeah. You said human farming, and I think that's another one. If you could expand on that and what you mean by that, because that's a very jarring term.
Well, so let's see. I think it's jarring, but only because just the way we're educated, right? So it's clear that people like to build companies, right? They like to say, okay, I can build this product and I can sell it over to this group, and we're gonna form a conspiracy to ship iPhones, right? Like that's clearly the thing that exists. And people get rewarded for that, right? If they build a good iPhone, then the stock price goes up, and you know, there's a good feedback loop there. I think that it's pretty obvious that can extend, that you can go bigger than that, right? And one of the ways that you can go bigger than that is, like George Soros, he made his money, instead of building iPhones, he started looking at currencies, right? And so what he did is he said, okay, I'm gonna put this conspiracy together and we're going to short the British pound. And the British pound is in a very tenuous place where it's kind of trying to stay pegged to these other European currencies, and their economy is not doing well. So we're gonna borrow a whole bunch of this money and then we're gonna sell it all at once and crash the price of it. And that's going to basically force a panic, and then we're going to be able to pay back what we owe at a much lower rate, right? And that kind of starts pushing people a little too far. Like that's clearly there, right? There's no, but you start getting to the point where you start getting emotional about it. You don't even want to believe that people would do something like that, right? But if you just think about the incentives involved, you know that stuff like that goes on, right? And what's happening at that level is, instead of like kind of buying and selling companies, you're basically buying and selling countries. And countries are, you know, it's a national border, but the main resource inside that national border is the people, right? The productivity of the people. So it's clearly happening. And it's not comfortable, I guess. It wasn't a comfortable topic for me to really think about. And like I said, putting the label slavery on it is still kind of uncomfortable, I guess. But it's there, right? It's clearly and obviously happening. And if you were wealthy enough, at a certain point, you know, if you have enough power, it makes sense that you would go from sort of playing in the in sort of the free market space. Like Bill Gates is a good example, right? So he creates Microsoft, he builds it up, and maybe he does some pretty aggressive to anti-competitive or whatever. But this is all like kind of gray area stuff, right? It's not really obvious. Like, yeah, maybe he screwed over Netscape Navigator and wouldn't ship it with the product or whatever. But all these companies do stuff like that, right? Like try to use Google apps on your iPhone right now. It's a pain in the butt. You know, whether it's because they deprioritize them or they're intentionally trying to make the competition not perform as well, whatever. I mean, it happens constantly. But Gates ends up in this situation where politicians in the U.S. are coming after him, right? They're putting their sights on him. And
And he could end up going to jail from it. And it looks like for a while there, they were going to break up Microsoft into smaller pieces. At that point, it forces him to become a politician, right? He can no longer just pretend that he can, you know, Ayn Rand, Hank Reardon, right? Like in that book, you know, he's clearly getting confronted with these politicians.
Right. And, they're asking him to bend the knee.
Right, exactly. And so at a certain point, if you become successful enough in business, you have to contend with politicians, which means you have to basically become a politician. Right. Which means you're a power broker, right? You're not just building products anymore. You're fighting over the power that exists, and the resources that are being produced by the local people, right? Like the people of the United States, or the people of the world, right? So even if you want to avoid getting into sort of buying and selling human beings, which is, you know, what you end up doing, I don't think you can avoid it. So you know, it's ugly, but the reality is that there slavery in all of its various forms that exist right now is profitable. And as long as it's profitable and somebody's willing to do it, then those people are going to get more power and influence from doing it. And there isn't a mechanism other than maybe Bitcoin to make it unprofitable by people just being harder to steal from. There certainly, until recently, has not been a mechanism to deal with that other than just being another slave owner yourself, right? Like if there's all these resources that are just laying around to be picked up that will make somebody more powerful, and you're morally opposed to doing that, you're not going to be the most powerful person around, right? That's just kind of simple math. I call it human farming or human cattle ranching. And it, you know, I do use those terms to be kind of jarring and disturbing, but at the same time, I also don't know how to describe the concepts that are clearly there in a more palatable way, because it's not a palatable thing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring up the Microsoft situation back then. And I think that, you know, Microsoft did bend the knee and kind of have to acquiesce a bit. And I think that, you know, that's kind of like the state co-opting corporate. And I think it's not too far from, you know, maybe, you know, Putin kind of throwing an oligarch in a cage in a trial. And because you got the threat of violence and physically removing him from society, maybe putting him in jail or something. But now I see the fight a little differently. And I'm not sure who's going to win between Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Twitter, and the state. I'm not sure who's co-opting who right now.
Yeah, it kind of depends on how you define the state. Like if you define the state as the political class that's willing to, that's a net beneficiary from the human farming, right? Like you're either being farmed, you're a net taxpayer would be one way to say it, net beneficiary. All of those companies are net beneficiaries because they're all protected from competition with all kinds of regulations. They all have lobbyists. That are giving them, you know, a constant stream of government favor, and you know, I mean, if nothing else, just being a publicly traded company, you have tons of government favor, right? Because you have this population of suckers that are forced to invest in something on the public market because their financial planner is saying, well, don't hold it in dollars. So you know, if nothing else, all these companies have a constant stream of cash and resources coming their way just because they're publicly listed. So I don't know where you would, you know, it's hard to draw a distinction between somebody like Zuckerberg and somebody like Trump, other than just fancy title, right? There's no question that Zuckerberg has many people on his staff that are you know, power brokers, right? And there's no question that Trump is both a power broker and, you know, works with other power brokers. So I like the concept of like political class, right? It's a group of people that are net beneficiaries and don't have any moral objection to playing the game and building the relationships that they need to build to get ahead and are, you know, relatively successful at doing that. So I think all those guys fall in that category. There's definitely a lot of lefties in Silicon Valley, so there's not any real moral objection to playing those sort of games. You know, they're not private property people, right? They're not going to say, whoa, whoa, whoa. It would be unethical for us to use this thing in this way and influence these people's decision-making. They all think that they're smarter than the average person, which they are. But they're also so arrogant that they think that they can make decisions for the average person, which is a leap they don't even know exists between just being smarter than them.
Right.
So yeah, I think they're all kind of a hot mess, and that's why I'm hopeful that over time we'll just build tools that make that activity not pay.
Right. So you know, it's interesting. You know, you go through the Human Threat Vector article and you outline several different kinds of slaveries, and I really recommend people dig into this. This is big brain stuff. So you know, socialist slavery, prohibition slavery, taxation. Racial, monopoly, legal tender, slavery. In this framework, are Bitcoin as revolutionaries?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they're abolitionists, right? I think that, and I think it was a very self-conscious abolitionist movement, right? When Tim May was writing in the 90s, and Adam Back was young and working on these sort of things. And Julian Assange was on the cypherpunk mailing list. I think all the way back then, it was a very self-aware abolitionist movement of people that were seeing that the average person was getting exploited already. And they were seeing that these new technologies could create a very dystopian future where the average person could be tracked and tagged and, you know, monitored in sort of excruciating detail that we're monitored right now. And they wanted to make that an unprofitable thing. And they saw in encryption specifically this really asymmetric tool, right? It's like gunpowder for giving power to the individual. Because with encryption, you can create what is the name of that book? There's a great book that Tim May recommended. That's all right. I'll think of it later. Sure. But in this book, there's this technology called bobbles that are created, and the idea is that if you have this device, you can basically create this sphere that's impenetrable, and you can put somebody in there, and everything's just frozen. It turns out it's only frozen temporarily, and it can be released later. So it's kind of this time travel thing. But what he describes seeing when he looked at encryption, he thought of it like, oh, this is like a bobble, right? With a little bit of energy, I can create this space that there's no amount of power or influence, money, technology, nothing can get into this space. I can create very cheaply this very self-contained safe area, this impenetrable bobble. And so they saw that as a way to create enough freedom initially to maybe create the cyberspace environment where over time they would be able to build up economic trade. They'd be able to trade information. You know, a corrupt politician would put something out or would do something, and that information would end up, you know, encrypted, distributed, signed all over the web. And that would start to actually create enough freedom in cyberspace to where it would start spilling out into regular space. They didn't think that, you know, there was this abolitionist movement in the South in pre-Civil War where they wanted to, and actually President Lincoln was one of these guys, where they wanted to take all the African slaves and they wanted to ship them off to Liberia, right? And so we've kind of had people like that in modern day, like the seasteaders, right? Like we're just going to go get our own space. It's going to be this, you know, hellacious space where you can't do any trade and you're surrounded by enemies and you can't really defend yourself and there's no natural resources, but hey, we're free. And the cypherpunk movement was saying, no, we don't want to do that. Even though there were some folks, Tim May specifically was like, no, I like California. California is nice. I want to stay right here, but I want to be free. So we're going to create freedom in cyberspace. And then that over time, we think will pour out into the meat space environment. So it definitely was a very self-aware sort of movement. And I think that it's impressive in that it's, you know, been working towards that in various ways for, you know, 30 years now. And right, we're seeing a lot of fruit of that now with Bitcoin.
Yeah. You know, as a Bitcoiner, I really look at the world as, you know, I'm hoping for the Great Awakening. But what I'm seeing now is I'm not sure if we're heading into the Great Reset to Eyes Wide Shut. And I'm curious, you know, are you optimistic or pessimistic for the next few years? And how does Bitcoin fit into that vision?
Yeah, I think I'm overall optimistic. Feeling, like I said at the beginning of this, feeling a little pessimistic today, but just because I was looking at just some dark characters and some pathetic characters, right? Like I look at a guy like George Soros and I don't see somebody that is terrifying. I see somebody that's just pathetic and pitiful, and I'd hate to be him. If you have any possible concept of your decisions having consequences and there being sort of judgment after this life, you got to see these guys as just the greatest tragedies of humanity. But you know, it's kind of depressing. So in general, I would say I'm pretty optimistic. Gosh, coronavirus caught me by surprise, and this whole, the amount of control and the amount of effectiveness that they had on this has been very shocking to me. But you know, I do think that because maybe this is the worst thing that's happened in my lifetime, I think that it is probably a little bit hard for me to have perspective. And I think if we step back and look at just what the world's like in general, there's a lot less poverty in the world. There's a lot of good things that are happening. The internet has, in a lot of ways, Rothbard lists out, I think, 7 different monopolies that the state has to maintain in order to remain in control. One of them is communication. The internet has crushed that. I think within that, you would say maybe propaganda. And you see what's happened with internet memes. Like the propaganda that the average teenager is cranking out now makes the propaganda that the state departments can put out not look that impressive. Again, they did amazing stuff with coronavirus, so they've still got some gas in the tank, clearly. But I think the internet has clearly disrupted the monopoly on communication to a bigger degree than we could have reasonably hoped for 50 years ago. 50 years ago there was 3 TV stations and a few radio stations, and everything was very, very carefully monitored. So that's a huge improement.
I'm not sure. I think they got control of the web and the social media and the algorithms. And if the real stuff is going to break through, the more they seize those mechanisms.
Yeah, but look at podcasting, right? So, I mean, Elon Musk was on Joe Rogan and he said, "Corona is crap." And he did it at the height of their project, right?
Yeah.
It didn't have the impact that I would have hoped that it would have, but you're not going to have that happen during World War II.
Right, but then they give Rogan $100 million, and I'm not sure he's going to keep up that dialogue. It seems like he still is, but they can co-op whoever they want.
It's not perfect. I don't want to say that it's perfect, right? But
and podcasts are great, but it's not person to person. Like stand-up comedy in a club. And that's like our what I think is one of the most effective ways to speak truth to power. I worry about that kind of mechanism or vertical, whatever you want to call it. You know, and
it's tough anytime that, it's a good example of like why we need to use internet technologies. Because if you have stand-up comedy, I mean, you can do stand-up speakeasies, but it's not nearly as easy as being able to do a podcast and having that distributed. Like they can shut down clubs. They still have enough funding to where they can have cops running around to every club, and
house,
knocking on the door and, taking your health certificate or whatever. But I don't think, maybe I'm wrong because I was certainly wrong about the amount of influence they had on Corona, but and maybe this is why I'm optimistic. I don't think that they could shut down podcasting. I think it would be, have a revolt if they tried to do that.
Right.
I think they have a lot of power on manipulating the sort of social media platform. But again, like 50 years ago, you and I wouldn't even know each other, right? Like Twitter is a dumpster fire. It's a nightmare, but
it's a battlefield.
It's been a lot easier. Yeah. Yeah. And I get blocked. If I go 8 weeks without a 2 to 3 day Twitter break, forced Twitter break, it's, I mean, I think for the last 2 years, every week I've been kicked.
Well, you throw out some doozies, you know, you throw out some really provocative questions. I think it's great. Yeah. You're pushing their algorithms, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, but, and it sucks, right? I'm sure it impacts my reach. I'm sure that I'm on a list where when I have had stuff, even like I got in a debate with George Selgin, and I was like, I'm not going to get blocked this time because this is a really good debate, and I'm going to crush this guy. I'm going to be super nice and just explain why he's completely wrong. And it got a lot of traction. I mean, I saw like, you know, a bunch of retweets all of a sudden, and libertarians were looking at it, and boom, I got kicked off. So I'm sure I'm on a list that's, you know, not favorable and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But 50 years ago, I wouldn't be on anything.
Right.
I'm not getting on TV.
We wouldn't hear your ideas.
Yeah. It's not getting out there at all.
I think that's something that's really powerful about, you know, you're one of those kind of anti-influencer anons, you know, it's powerful. It helps you cut through the noise. It's hard to digest at first. Again, I'm taking advice from Chewbacca or whatever this picture is, and this random name. And you really made me think a lot with both your tweets and your writings. And one thing I really, you know, I want to get in here, mathbot.com. You know, my son, he's turning 8. He just turned 8 today, and my dream is coming true. He came to me. He said he wants to, he loves coding. Awesome. I want to get him out of school, and I want him coding all day. I want him on mathbot.com, so he's going to be making me $400,000 a year by the time he's 12.
Exactly.
You know, yeticold.com, you know, you're kind of a foremost expert on security. Your article, The Bitcoin Threat Model, I think is really great for people who are trying to understand Bitcoin from a security framework. And you really lay it out nice there. And you have the background for it. And 10 hours of Bitcoin.com. I really want to front this because it's a great way to bring people or not bring new coiners, pre-coiners, but really Bitcoiners. And I like the groove you put people on here with, you know, the 10 minutes from the Bitcoin Standard Prologue. 3 hours where you walk people through Bitcoin and economics, 30 minutes, Bitcoin Under the Hood. It's a video, and 2 articles, 1 hour each from Nick Szabo, shelling out the origins of money, blockchains, and social scalability. These were, you know, just these are huge, monumental pieces for understanding money. And this concept of social scalability really blew my mind when I went through this. 1 hour of your article, The Bitcoin Threat Model. I really implore people who are kind of curious about the technology and the threats and understanding the landscape of really any piece of software, go through that. We covered it a lot, but we didn't get into all of it. The 1 hour, you know, in the human threat model. Again, this was something that I read 1 or 2 years ago that took me a long time to sit on. I don't think I would have been ready an hour 8 for this, to be honest, to really digest this. These are ideas I had to just really marinate on. And then you have a couple more that are kind of like more forward looking and walking people through what's going to happen next with the Lightning Network overview, 1 hour, and Simplicity Smart Contracts, 30 minutes, and the Liquid Sidechain. Again, these are even topics that I'm still trying to grok 3 years in. So I really, you know, thank you for everything you're contributing to this space. And I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation.
Right on, man. I still feel bad that I am not leaving on a high note. So let me throw out here some
yeah, man,
unadulterated optimism. So yes, COVID has been very disturbing, but Bitcoin is working. The price is strong. So that means adoption as a savings technology is strong. We've seen corporations. I didn't expect this to happen. I mean, I'm blown away by this.
Yeah, when corporations are backing your protest, I don't know what you got protest for.
Right, exactly. And, you know, if they start adding that to their treasury, we don't even need central banks to start doing it. Right?
Not needed.
We can end the U.S. dollar, you know, just with, I don't know, what, 20 or 30 more corporations of this size getting on board. It wouldn't take much, which is, it's incredible how close we could be to ending a lot of this nonsense.
Yeah.
My original prediction, you know, in 2017 when I got in was about 2040. I think we'll have Bitcoin adopted as global money. we're on track. We might even be a little ahead of schedule on that. And for something that's super optimistic, we may, with this discrete log contracts that are coming out, have enough technology now to do private insurance contracts. And what that would mean is that you would be able to take out insurance on somebody else or yourself and say, if somebody steals this guy's money, I want to get paid.
Yeah. Right?
And that could be something that is, that applies to governments as well. So you got, you know, your cousin is in Zimbabwe. You don't want them to get robbed by anybody, including the local dictator. You can take out this insurance. It creates this really interesting anonymous incentive to keep your cousin safe from everybody, including government thugs. So there is some really, really interesting, crazy, world-changing potentially stuff that could be right around the corner. So overall, I think, you know, I wouldn't rather be alive at any other point in history. I really want to see how this plays out. I think it's going to be good.
That's awesome. JW Weatherman ending on a high note. And I do those tweets you've been putting out lately on the black markets and the betting and how that can kind of eradicate some issues that mankind is facing or humanity is facing. Really interesting stuff and probably going to take up a whole other chat. So this has been so dope, man. I'm so happy you came on the show. We put this together like in 3 days. I really appreciate it.
Right on, man. It was a ton of fun.
Digging into some controversy right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. And for episode number 10, I'm gonna leave you with this. Don't be good little Bitcoiners. Be great.